Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 55 of the Electric Sale Podcast. And boy, have we got a podcast for you. Well, we've always got a podcast for you because, you know, it'd be a kind
It's a podcast.
Because it's a podcast, yeah, and we're doing it for you. So, you know, it's a kind of tautology. I think it's a tautology. First rule of tautology club is... Anyway, so...
What does tautology mean?
Oh, I can't remember now. Linda, what's a tautology?
A tautology?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So a tautology is saying the same thing sort of twice, really. So it's like if you say return back to, that's a tautology.
Okay.
So first rule of tautology club is the first rule of tautology club.
Okay. Worth it. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, so we got my dear old friend Sir Lenny Henry in our tradition of doing both Marxist theoreticians and leading lights of the world of comedy. We've got Sir Lenny Henry. It's very revealing. I've known Lenny a long time. And we've been through some ups and downs together. And I think if you're interested in comedy, you'll find it. Comedy and comedians, you'll find it fascinating.
What a journey and a life, man.
Yeah, I mean, what an extraordinary...
I didn't realise how early he'd started.
Oh, shit, yeah.
As like a 15. Kid.
Yeah, as a child, yeah.
But that was like, what, mid-70s, early 70s? And
yeah, early 70s. Well, I first met him in 81, so, and he was, yeah. But yeah, he's been working since he's like 15 or something, yeah.
Because people like you and Lenny are people I grew up, they were completely mainstream on television, like prime time.
Lenny, you know, more than me, but yeah.
They would be so in your vision all the time.
Mm.
You didn't realize that they've been spending 25 years working up to that point, you know.
Wasn't it? I mean, it was 10 years. I guess it was 10 years with Len, but yeah.
No, because I'm talking about the 90s for me.
When
he was on telly all the time.
Yeah.
That's when you had your sketch shows in the 90s.
Yeah, well, it was sort of late 80s, early 90s. Yeah, that was the peak of my TV career.
Mm. Well, it's very nice chat, and you can see the admiration between both of you.
Mm,
you can feel it.
He's so attractive, really. I mean, apart from anything else, I mean, he's just, as he's aged, really, he's got so good looking.
Yeah, and stylish.
And stylish, yeah. Mm. Yeah, which, you know, is, I think, part of his knowing who he is, I think. So, anyway, have we got anything else to discuss? Not like there's anything going on in the fucking outside world.
You know what? Let's keep the energy up. We'll have a chat at the end of the episode. We'll be back for a little chat, yeah?
All right, Lenny Henry. Normally I say I don't do any research or, you know, into whatever my guest is talking to. And that, you know, that can, you know, lead to problems. You know, are you still doing that thing where you do that, you know, with the thing where you, you know, in your particle physics? My guest today, I need to do no research since we've known each other since 1981, whatever that is, 43.
Long time.
No, and obviously I knew you. Beforehand, ladies and gentlemen, my guest on today's podcast, Sir Lenny Henry.
If there was a posse here, they'd all be clapping now.
Yeah.
Back in the day on the radio, but it's just me and you.
Yeah.
I'm not going to clap myself, although there is a precedent. There's a working men's club in Glasgow where I literally had to clap at the end because it was such a bad reception. Hooray, good night, everybody. And walk off to the sound of my own footsteps.
Well, we'll get to that in time. I don't know where to, actually. I don't know where to start. Should we start with us meeting, or should we start with you, sort of your early years? Really,
but well, I mean, I always feel worried when people say, "Let's go back to the very beginning." But it's very beginning is interesting for us because I was a fan of yours before I met you. I'd been to the comedy store comic strip with my friend Joe Charles. And the night was you, which was funny, scary, Rick and Aid, funny, mad, Pete and Nige, funny, weird, Arnold Brown, funny. Kill that phone.
That's highly unprofessional. I usually switch it off.
Unprofessional.
Yeah, go on.
Arnold Brown, funny, random, and Dawn and Jennifer, funny, funny. So it was a very, very good night. But my interest in you was that I was a comedian and I was very much in another milieu. I was a stand-up comedian in light entertainment. And I'd never seen anybody attack the audience with such force. And also with this idea of fearlessness, of not really caring whether the audience liked the material or not. And I kind of was, and I know in deep inside where your engines are running, you do care. But actually the appearance was, God, this guy's just saying stuff and he doesn't give a monkeys. And I loved it. I really liked it. And I thought that one of the things I came away from that experience was I could do a bit more of that. I'm too much wanting the audience to be happy and trying to please the audience all the time, and I'm doing anything to please them. And that was the beginning of me changing how I did my thing.
Right.
And it made me listen more to people like Richard Pryor and Steve Martin and George Carlin, just because I like this idea of, A, approaching it from another way, from another angle. And also, the Lexi principle was don't you don't have to play to the gallery. You need to be thinking about what you want to do.
Right.
So that was my introduction to you. And then we met because you did a show called a legendarily terrible show called OTT for Central Television.
Yeah.
And you were our resident alternative comedian for 8 or 9 weeks before you went to Australia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I met you on a lovely day where we played foreign tennis players. Where Chris Tarrant played an umpire. I don't know what the point of the sketch was.
I remember it was snowing.
There were no jokes.
Yeah.
I remember I had to do a kind of over-the-top random African accent.
Yeah.
I know you were playing a random Albanian person. Yeah. And I know that it wasn't very funny.
Yeah.
But afterwards, I said to you, I'm a big fan of yours. And you went, oh, I'm a big fan of yours or something. I used to love Tiz Was. Yeah. And we just got on. Despite the fact that we've just been one of the worst sketches ever conceived by man or animal. And we got on really well. And I was very respectful to you because you were in a space where you didn't really want much contact. And on the day of the show, you were very much in your own world. But in between that, you seemed to be a very decent, nice bloke.
Yeah.
And which came as a surprise whenever I said, oh, look, he's all right, you know. People were very surprised by that.
Yeah. Well, that confused me as well, really. I never knew quite how to behave. But, OTT, it was, I think after I did that sketch, I said, I'm not going to be any more sketches.
You were, though, because Tarrant was very persuasive. You did a Naughty Norman sketch.
Oh, God.
And you did a couple of other things.
Right.
But generally, you basically just did your thing.
Yeah.
And I knew, my experience of it was, when you went off on the tour in Australia, I knew Tarrant didn't get what he'd done by introducing you to the general public because you were very, very popular on OTT. But the next week, he had Bernard Manning on.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, he doesn't get what Lexi did. He could have easily gone to Dawn and Jennifer or one of the other comedians and said, come and do 5 minutes on OTT, but he didn't. Okay. He just got Bernard Manning on for kind of shock value.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the point of view. The point of view was, oh, this is another perspective. This is another way of presenting stand-up in a way that you've not seen. It's not set up punch. It's set up, hello, I'm from Zimbabwe. It was set up and situation and concept. And he just thought it was about shock value.
Yeah.
And I really get on well with Chris and got on well with him.
Yeah.
But I thought he made a mistake there.
Yeah. I mean, it was funny. I mean, because he was very from a very different world. And I did land him in quite a lot of trouble on several occasions. But
and how?
With the regulator, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, you Ofcom. Ofcom, we knew Ofcom was on the phone because the phone was actually melted on the mantelpiece.
Yeah.
Where people were like, I've been watching OTT, Lexi Sales, and people struggling themselves in Middle England.
The spam off the seats.
Yeah, that was it, yeah. But it was really good fun.
Yeah.
And we got to the end of it. the thing I remember about this is in a book I wrote called Rising to the Surface, but the thing I remember about the first night of OTT was Chris taking us to the Limassol in Birmingham.
Right.
Took the cast. I don't know if you were there. You might have gone home straight away.
I used to go home straight away. I might have come that first night.
The first night he took us to the Limassol in Birmingham, really late opening Greek restaurant.
Yeah.
And we got the worst. It wasn't a bollocking, really. It was him thinking aloud about how terrible the show was.
Right.
But it was very shame-making. We all felt very...
He wrote it and produced it.
He did most of the work on it. So
yeah.
It was almost like he was lambasting himself.
Right.
But we were also in firing range.
Yeah.
And then the next week what happened was extraordinary, actually, because we all went, well, we're not going to do that this week.
Right.
And everybody worked harder. And I think I came up with three new characters, and we just said, let's make it as good as we can make it.
Right.
And bearing in mind, it's not like today where you go and do tryouts at a little theatre before the show. We wrote new material and did it on stage.
Live.
So we just did it.
Yeah.
So it was a very risky show to do. And there's some of it that I'm proud of. There's a lot of it where, I mean, my manager did say, you know, I can pay ITV to get you out of this.
It's a dog's breakfast, Lenny.
It's a dog's breakfast, Lenny. I can get you out of it, Mr. Love.
Have you told that story about, you know, going home that first
Oh,
night?
God. So I stayed in Birmingham after the first show, which was appalling. We did get 9 million viewers though. Drove home to where my mum was, and because I was going to stay there the next day. And usually it's a busy, bustling suburban street with people washing cars and children playing ball and little girls skipping. And as I'm driving towards my mum's house, it's like a disto. It's coming like a ghost town. It's empty. The street's empty. There's an overturned trike on somebody's lawn. There's a kind of wet sponge on the top of a car and suds dripping down. There's children looking through curtains through the window. I park the car. I go in the house. There's nobody around, it seems. And I'm knackered, so I go, I'm going to go and have a bath. And I run the bath, get in the bath, and I'm lying there thinking about last night and what we were going to do next week. And I hear my brother Paul go, it was terrible, wasn't it? Sean goes, what are we going to do? Paul goes, I don't know. Let's just be honest, like we normally are. Paul goes, I know, but it was really bad. It was triple bad. It was quadruple bad. Mom says, leave him alone. You know, he bought me a television. And it just went on like that for ages. And I got out of the bath and went downstairs. And basically, Paul and Sharon, who are my brother and sister, kind of were, they didn't sugarcoat it. They just said what was wrong.
Yeah.
And I went in on the Monday and just said, we've got some work to do. And I think Delbert happened that week.
Oh, right. Okay.
So, you know.
Yeah, well, it's catastrophe. I mean, I think that, that is a sort of rule for, you know, aspiring comedians in a sense. It's your real, I mean, I'm sure somebody has said this before, but it's your real disasters that, you know. I mean,
I can't imagine you going through that. Did you
go twice.
Through that?
Twice. Really? Yeah. The first time, I was talking about this at Glastonbury on Sunday that...
anything for a free ticket. You podcasters.
I hate it.
They gave me a freebie.
I hated it. But I'd done the sketch where I pointed a gun at the audience when I try out at the Elgin, and then I took it to the Comedy Store Saturday night. And just, as I said, a young piece of advice for young comedians, don't point a really realistic looking gun at the audience. It makes them nervous. Surprising, don't scream at them. And then the second time was, well, I suppose that predated that. When I went up to Edinburgh, when me and Tony Adam went up to Edinburgh and invented stand-up comedy at the Edinburgh Fringe, the first night I died on my ass because I still, for some reason, because I'd been doing just emceeing at the Comedy Store, everything was in little packages.
Yeah.
I've absolutely died on my
ass. You didn't
arse.
Have a kind of coherent...
No, exactly. Did
you do half an hour?
Yeah, exactly. But I did it in like blocks and it really died. And like, you know, that.
It's hard.
Well, that terrible, you know, where like the backstage crew won't look at you and stuff like that. I mean, it's like, it's profoundly.
You get a very light round of applause as you leave the stage.
Yeah.
And there's no cup of tea waiting for you when you get off there.
And I just...
got to get your own cab.
I was stayed up all night. I was really upset. And then I kind of blew the act completely apart. And that's when the character that you saw at the comic strip really came into being was when... because I just, you know, I put like punchlines before setups kind of thing. You know, I blew it apart. And that's when really my my persona.
It's good to hear you say that. Because at the first time I saw it, I just thought this is a perfectly shaped and conceived performance. And I had no idea who you were. I hadn't really talked to you at the beginning. But I knew that when you watch you, and hopefully me, doing that, you do understand that behind it, there's a lot of thought gone into it.
Yeah.
You don't just happen into that persona.
I don't know that anybody does, really. I think it comes from just doing endless stand-up as well. I mean, you can't do it without, you know.
I remember saying I said to Billy Connolly after I'd seen him a few times, I said, have you got a little man in the shed in the back garden of your house who helps you with it? Is there a murder wall of material in your house? How have you got? And he didn't say anything. But I figure it's often that you can bounce it off someone, like a friend or a close colleague.
Yeah.
And I think it's misery on your own, I think, if doing stand-up. Misery loves company. And I think that I had Kim for ages, Kim Fuller. And I know you had Linda and you worked with Taff and stuff. You do need somebody to go, like Seinfeld says, is this something?
Yeah.
Is this any good?
Yeah.
Because it's just that nod of the head of, yeah, that's funny, that makes you go, okay. And then you go on that night and it works.
Yeah.
Or it some of it works and a bit of it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, I'm going to fix that. I can fix that.
But I think you do need every, you know, I don't think there's, I can't imagine there's a comic who doesn't have somebody.
Well, Richard Pryor had Paul Mooney. Yeah. And I didn't know Richard Pryor had Paul Mooney.
Yeah.
I just kept thinking, and there's a definite line between the early albums and performances of Richard Pryor and the latter material. Because in the latterly, Richard Pryor's material became more focused and more, they led to punchlines. It allowed him to be groovy and to riff, but you definitely had a shape for each routine. And I think that was Paul Mooney's influence. And then the other day, I'm watching a documentary about Steve Martin, and a guy is in the documentary, not for very long. He says, oh, yeah, well, Steve and I wrote a lot of the material together. And I went, bing! Of course you did. There's far too many weirdnesses and concepts and ideas and for one person. He must have bounced this stuff off somebody.
Yeah.
So, you know, misery loves company, kids.
Yeah.
Get a collaborator and see what
absolutely,
you come up with.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, this is nice.
Oh, good. Okay. Like,
well, because so many things now are, you know, we're doing this cooking thing, or this is about tailoring, or this is about space travel, or this is about the stars, or this is about, you know, carpeting. Yeah. Everybody's got a vibe or a concept for their podcast. And you kind of have to fit in, you know, five flowers that you want to talk about. And so it's so nice to just be able to chat.
Yeah, actually. I think so. Yeah. Well, we do.
We'd be doing this, listeners, by the way, in a restaurant down the road with a spag bol and a cup of tea normally. Yeah. So this is good.
I mean, in many ways, just to sort of go back a bit, you're also sort of strange bridge between the past and then the present, in the sense that when you started out, I mean, you've talked a lot about, I guess, you know, the new faces and all that, but it's still, I mean, you talk, just for me, when we talked about that lonely black kid being sent up to fucking Aberdeen for a week, you know, I mean,
it was really hard. I mean, and boohoo, I bought mom a house and a telly and carpet. And
but that was for air. That was not for you.
Yeah,
you know?
It did feel a bit like I was the one that was responsible for my family's, you know, being looked after. And I took it on. You know, I was the one that made it, so it was my job to do the carpet and the telly in the house and all that kind of stuff. But on the road was hard, very, very hard.
And it was also
because I felt a bit lost.
Well, yeah, but you were a child.
Yeah, I was 16.
Know.
So and then, you know, there were circuits in Britain back
then. Well,
it was
the dying ember of variety, wasn't it, what you were doing? Can you tell the Eric Morecambe story?
I did.
Before you tell it, but just I think it's such a, like a, it's like a, it's a, an elision between the old time and the new time, but it's also something that's timeless about being a comic. And it's also lovely that he was giving you a piece of advice. Anyway, go ahead.
Eric Morecambe and Ernie Wise were like huge titans of show business by the time I started in the industry. And they were a double act and they'd been going for years. And they were just, whenever you saw them, the television show didn't really reflect what they were like live. Live, they were extraordinary.
Really?
The audience loved them. And you just, I worked with them once, and you just floated on the audience's good feeling when you did your set. Yes. It was just a perfect place to do comedy because they really wanted it. And they wanted it to be good, and they laughed loud and long. And then when Eric and Ernie came on, it was just like, what? How are they doing this? It was brilliant.
Yeah.
So I was a big fan of Eric and Ernie, more so Eric than Ernie. And I did a gig on the Isle of Wight. It was a Royal Variety show. And I was doing 10 minutes in the first half. And I went on. And back in the day when I started, listeners, I used to do a lot of material against myself because the only role models in this country were Charlie Williams, If You Don't Laugh, I'll Come and Move In Next Door to You, and Joss White and Sammy Thomas, who were black comedians on this show called The Comedians. And they told sort of racist jokes against themselves, against the color of their skin. You know, so you'd be sweating, you'd wipe your brow, lick it and go, I'm leaking. Ooh, it's chocolate. You'd do things like that.
Yeah.
So very gentle. I was the Beano and the Dandy version of that, but I was still doing it. So I was doing all that material, and I got big laughs and everything. And then later on at the party, after we'd met the Royals, Eric Morecambe came up to me and took me to one side and said, that was good, lad. You did very well. He said, you never have to do that nigger stuff for anybody, he said. And I was shocked because this is a national treasure using the N-word. Nobody uses the N-word in my circles.
Yeah.
Nobody in my family uses the N-word. I've been called it a few times at school, but I'd never heard a grown-up who I respected saying the word. He said, you don't ever have to be that N-word for anybody. He said, you should find your material and do that. Don't do what anybody else is doing and stand up for yourself. Just do what you want to do. And then he walked off. And I was literally in shock. And it took a long time to understand what he was. At first, I was offended because Mary Merkham just said the N-word. But afterwards, I thought, no, actually, he's right. You're right. Why am I doing their material? Why am I doing my material? And it took ages to navigate my way around what he meant. And it meant listening to Richard Pryor, who was also problematic, and, you know, Cosby. And I listened to a lot of American comedians trying to understand the journey towards being your true, authentic self on stage. And some could argue, well, you never got there. But actually, I think it's the attempting to get it that gets you where you want to be. I think, you know, the Beatles wanted to be Bob Dylan or the Everly Brothers and ended up being themselves. And I think it's the reaching for perfection that ends up where you want to be.
That's a fantastic story, but it's not the one I want to
use. Oh, shit, sorry.
But you can what about where you're running long?
Oh, that one.
Oh, that's the story you told is about, you know, it's a profound interaction between a... I remember, but it's a profound, it's actually some moment that changed you. It says something about the culture. The story that I want you to tell is just
I'm so
about...
sorry.
No. You came up with a better one than
okay. Oh, this one's just about I was doing Morecambe and Wise Sunday concert in Bournemouth, where there are no black people at all, it seems to me. So I get down there and I'm very nervous because it's Eric and Ernie. This is the biggest act in the country. Their last Christmas special got 26 million viewers. So shit,
that's the population.
It's everywhere. Yeah. So it's a big responsibility. I've got to do well. I arrive, and when I get backstage, Eric Morecambe meets me and goes, hello, lad, how are you? And he leads me into his dressing room.
Wow.
He says, here's the fridge. There's beers in the fridge. Have what you want. There's a telly. Watch telly. Enjoy yourself. And just have a good time today. And then he goes off, and that's my first meeting with Eric Morecambe. Yeah. I go on in the first...
still isn't the story. Yeah, but go on.
I go on stage. I'm down for...
there we go.
I'm down for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And I do 18 because the audience is so brilliant.
Yeah.
I get a bollocking from the stage manager.
It's extraordinary that a fucking stage manager could give you a bollocking.
How dare you do that? Well, this is the Eric and Ernie show.
Yeah.
You're not down for 18. You're down for 15. It's a disgrace.
Yeah.
You better do your time or I'll report you to your manager and I'll get your money docked, he said.
Yeah. I mean, that was the old variety theatre. It was like that. It was very punitive. With
comics.
You
really
used to get banned for, you know, fined for having dirty shoes and stuff.
It was all that. Anyway. So I'm in my dressing room and I didn't dare go in Eric and Ernie's room after that. But Eric knocked on the door and put his head around the door. He said, all right, lad. I said, yeah. He said, did very well first half. I said, yes. He said, did you go over? I said, yes, I got a bollocking. He said, yeah. He said, forget that guy. He said, next time when you come off, tell him, well, I cut the shoe routine. Say I cut the shoe routine. It should have been on time.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened. He said, say that and see what he says. So I did 19 in the second half, killed. And I came off stage, and the stage manager was there, and his face was red. And I said, well, I don't know what happened. I cut the shoe routine. I don't know what happened. He looked at me and went, oh, you cut? Oh, okay. And he was a bit fuzzled. Yeah. And then he just sent me off on my way.
Yeah.
And there was nothing he could do because that was my last set anyway.
Yeah.
Arsehole.
Yeah. But, I love that menu, Save. But that's a world where you allied the kind of the ancient variety, you know, something that's been going since Victorian music hall and something newer and different. But I like
that Eric Morecambe was a nice guy.
Yeah.
Ernie was different. I think Ernie was more old school, professional. He wanted to be in Hollywood, probably thought that showbiz and Bournemouth was a bit beneath him, but did it because his mate was still doing it.
Yeah.
But Eric was very much, this is my house. These are my jokes. Here we go. And I was very privileged to be able to see them do it. And it was legendary. I mean, of all of them, they were non-racist, non-sexist. Well, they did sexy jokes, but they didn't do sexist jokes, really. Yeah. They were literally lightning on stage.
Yeah. And they weren't obnoxious.
No, they weren't.
Yeah.
They did rude jokes, but they were kind of double entendre kind of things. Yeah.
So OTT is... Did it continue? I mean, actually, what I was going to say was that Clive James, now dead a few years, but an interesting character, and he was the first person to do TV criticism as make it an art, really, rather than just, you know.
He did a brilliant review.
Well, he wrote about OTT that he said the reason that it's despised by other critics is because it's one, it's not Reithian, that there's no attempt to educate. You know, there's no attempt to kind of
communicate.
Yeah,
none of those.
In a time when most television was still very buttoned up, it was unrestrained. And he said the other thing was that the reason that the critics say it's because it came from the Midlands. It was very explicitly Birmingham, you know.
And there's a lot of class in
I think
there.
He hated me, but well, we became friends later. But
there's the whole class thing is, you know, if you think about the difference between Tiswas and the multicolored swap shop, the idea that one was run by people who were very much involved in the whole nanny state of, you know, this is a show your children could do their homework to. And Tiswas was literally a show where you threw your homework out the window on fire and ran around throwing buckets of water at each other. Yeah. It just had a similar thing of, this is not to educate or inform, although there were bits of that in Tiswas because they had to.
Yeah.
But it was very much a show to have fun to and to listen to your favourite band and to watch Bugs Bunny. And I stand by it.
Yeah.
And people today come up to me and say, oh, Len, the best thing you ever did. And I go, here we go. Tiswas. Oh, man, the Phantom Flanflinger spit that I've played Othello. No, but that bit when Bernard Manning got blown up by the Speak Your Weight machine, that was classic. You know, you just think.
Yeah, yeah.
People freeze you in the time when they loved you the best.
Yeah.
So, and Tiswas, you do a straw poll. With me, it's Tiswas. People love the... Because I was 19.
And you can't... I get a similar thing, I suppose, with young ones. It's you can't rail against it. It's fine, you know.
It's fine. And also, I've had a long career, thank God. Thank you to the gods.
I think we would maybe feel different about it if we hadn't had long careers yet.
Can you imagine?
Oh, man, I'd be so unhappy. Well,
can I tell you a story?
Yeah.
I got a PhD, and I went to collect it. And I thought, well, finally, you know, I played Othello, I've done an MA, I've got a PhD now, you know, finally the past can be put to, but this is who I am now. And as I'm walking down with the scroll, I heard this bloke go, okay, really? Really, pal?
Yeah.
All right, Lenny, Katanga, my friends. It never goes away. Never.
No. You know, I think you have to learn to live with that, really. It's not...
It's what you did. You've got to own it. A friend of mine said, you just have to own that shit.
Yeah,
that's what you've done. Own all of it. Yeah. Own the Black White Minstrels. Own the stupid jokes you used to do. Own, you know, dying on your ass on the Beverly Circuit in Yorkshire. Own being called a coon in Wales. Own it, because it's you. Yeah. And then you can tell people those stories.
Yeah.
They're your stories.
Yeah.
So that's what I do.
So anyway, so after OTT, what comes next?
Oh, I did the Lenny Henry Show, and you were in that.
Yeah.
We remained
friends.
I did Three of a Kind, then the Lenny Henry Show. And Three of a Kind won all kinds of awards. And I got to work with Tracy Ullman, and David Copperfield, not the David Copperfield, but a David Copperfield.
Yeah.
His name was Stan Barlow, and he was from Doncaster, and his dad was a miner. But he was a kind of, David wanted to be like Freddie Starr. But actually, he was a singer, and he was a multi-instrumentalist. He was very talented. And I did a regretful summer season with him afterwards. But he was very talented.
I think me and my mum came to see you in Blackpool.
He was very talented, and he always got a standing ovation. The thing about doing the clubs up north is you get a stander if you're a muso. So they like the jokes, but if you can play Cavatina on the guitar, we'll stand up for you. And it was most nights David would get a stander. It was very infuriating.
Yeah.
But so me, Trace and David won the Golden Rose of Montreux, BAFTA nominated, Variety Club Grappin. And it was we got between 8 and 10 million viewers on a certain night.
Which channel was that on?
Three of a Kind.
It was on BBC One.
First season was on on BBC Two. Then we moved to BBC One,
right,
which is a BBC move. And then when we broke up the band, Tracy went to ITV to do Girls on Top with Jen and Dawn.
Yeah.
And Paul Jackson, the producer, director, went with them. And Paul Jackson said, well, I'll do your show with you. But he left. And the BBC got me in, and I was very upset. And they said, we've got Jeff Posner will do it. Jeff Posner had just done Carrots Lib and a second block of The Young Ones. And so I got Jeff, and Jeff and I remained collaborators for the rest of the 80s. He was fantastic. He really knew his stuff. And so Lenny Henry Show, you know, BAFTA nominated and all that. You were in that. We did, I used to love Boys in the Black Stuff. So we did two for Billy and Gazza, shot in the same way as Boys in the Black Stuff. And you were Gazza, and you were a surreal mate. And we'd have these walks and have these weird conversations. I enjoyed that series, but I only did two seasons of it because I saw the comic strip and I was jealous. And I kept thinking, half hour narrative, single camera comedy, that's where it's at, man. And I wanted to do that. And also Dawn was my partner, and I wanted to, she kept saying, you need to stop doing sketches now because people aren't doing sketches anymore, man. They're doing this kind of thing. And so I kind of, the next season was Lenny Henry Tonight, and I did 6 half hours of, and it was lumpy, but there were a couple of good things in it. And out of that, Stan and Andrew, who wrote a thing called What a Country, which is the best one, they wrote Delbert. And we did 2 seasons of Delbert, which was arguably one of the most coherent things I did at the end of the 80s. And then after that, I did Live and Unleashed, the stand-up comedy film, and got spotted by Disney, who said, come and do this movie that Eddie Murphy doesn't want to do anymore. And off I went to Hollywood with a song in my heart and dreams in my head. And oh dear.
Well, we've all been
the shit hit the fan there.
It doesn't happen anymore, does it? I do feel we have, in a sense, been unlucky. I mean, Dawn had I think it was Dawn who had this theory. I think she advanced this theory to me. At that time, that all leading Hollywood actors had a fund where they'd chip in. Then they'd lure promising British talent over to Hollywood.
And kill them.
Well, in a sense, professionally, yeah. They'd ritually humiliate, because it happened to you, it happened to me, it happened to Rowan, I think. It happened to Rick. Angry earlier. So they have this kind of fund, Humiliate British Talent Fund.
I don't think that's true.
But it was an interesting comic idea from your ex-wife.
It was interesting, though, because it was deliberate, like they didn't want it to be any good.
Well, that's what I'm saying, yeah.
Like 45 drafts of a script.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I literally thought, this is quite a good script. I'll get Richard Curtis to read it, see what Richard says.
Yeah.
Richard wrote some notes on the script and said, well, if you've sort that out, I think it's quite funny, but just do these things and blah, blah, blah. Dawn was there. We went to quite a lot of meetings with different writers, and literally every other day we got a new draft. And then at the end of every month, they changed the writer and did a new version of the script.
It's like that sitcom I was on. There was 8 different scripts in the first week. And that was not just like scripts that were altered. It was like in completely different storylines.
So it's a real problem in terms of, and it's a Katzenberg / Ovitz model, in that those guys are from TV. So when you work in sitcom, what happens is the script is ever changing. The script is mutating all the time.
They rewrite between
And then on the night in front of the audience, you do a scene, the writers watch it, they go away, huddle, and they come back with 15 lines that they put into the script.
Yeah,
say, we're going to do another take and do these jokes now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's a slight lack of respect for the set text over there. And my experience was the lack of confidence in this text that keeps changing is making me lose confidence in my decision to come here. And a sensible person would have gone, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go and do this script. I'm going to stay in this country. I'm going to work with people I know who are going to help me make something that we want to do. But instead I went, hooray for Hollywood! And I just went over there thinking it was going to be great, and it wasn't great. And one of the things I learned was I met Eddie Murphy. And he was great, actually. Had a movie go. I said, oh, not, it, I don't think it went very well. He said, I think I need a manager. You don't need no manager. He said, you just need to use your common sense, he said. And he said, do the things you want to do. Don't do what other people want to do. And then he told me this thing of, I'm not going to do the voice. He said, they kept saying I've got an entourage everywhere I go. He said, you know who those people are? I said, no. He said, it's my brother, the guy I write with, my best mate, and my stepdad. They sit by the monitor sometimes. This was early doors.
Right.
They sit by the monitor and they give me the thumbs up, or they give me the shaky hand and say, do that again. And that's it.
Right.
They're my mates who are with me to be my support network, because nobody else gives a monkeys about me out there. They're all waiting for me to fail, and I don't want to fail. So I got my mates with me. And I thought, yeah.
And then probably later on, he got rid of those people and then did fail.
Well, yeah, I think I think that's right. I think when he stopped having that support network with him, it got a bit wobbly then.
Yeah.
It was still brilliant, but it was some choices were made that you probably wouldn't have done back in the day.
Yeah.
When he was, by the way, when he was 19, 20, 21, made some of the biggest movies ever.
Yeah.
And then after that, started to make dodgy decisions.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you've made $1 billion for Warner Brothers, I guess your head can be turned.
I've yet to have that experience.
Me too.
I still have it
to me.
So, okay, so you got, what was the film called, the Disney film?
I did a film called True Identity.
True Identity.
And, enjoyable experience without, if you took away the actual work and the experience of being on camera, the actual experience of being in LA for a long time and working with the people I was working with who were lovely, and being with all the expats who moaned all the time. So, you know, I met Jeff Lean from ELO and George Harrison.
They all play cricket, don't they, in the Hollywood Hills?
I didn't experience that, but I met a lot of expats who moaned about being in LA and having to take all that money.
Yeah.
Having to take all that money for being in development.
Got
to play snooker with George Harrison. So I had a nice time. And I got to meet in Lafrenière and Dick Clement, and that was nice. And Jonathan Lynn, and that was lovely. Who were very good with advice, and Cleese gave good advice. And, I've got a good story about, I went to dinner with Robbie Coltrane, Eric Idle, and Jonathan Lynn. And Jonathan Lynn was just about to shoot Bilko. And so we sat down, me and Eric and Robbie, with Jonathan Lynn. And Eric said, so you're doing Bilko? And Jonathan said, yes. And then Robbie went, oh, Bilko, my favorite. And then for the next 20 minutes, just did excerpts from every single episode of Bilko he could remember, doing all the voice, come on. Hey, Sergeant. He just did all these voices, all these characters. Hilarious. The staff were laughing. We were laughing. And at the end, Eric Idle looked at Jonathan Lynn and said, so do you think the casting's right, Jonathan? And Jonathan Lynn sort of looked
who
a bit
who played Bill Show
in the end, it was Steve, and Steve wasn't really right for it.
Tremendous flop, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a big flop.
Yeah.
And we kind of called it early doors.
Yeah.
Because Steve's too... Steve's brilliant, but everything's placed and thought through. And whereas with Phil Silvers, you get this massive sense of freedom, kind of early Robin Williams of, I'm just going to go and see what comes out. He was a real Borscht Belt comedian, Vegas comedian, so he was very much... Where are you from? Where you kids from? He was very much that kind of comic and could riff in the moment.
Yeah, he was. I mean, the Harry, hurry up, you know, the way where the monkey gets.
Phil Silvers was extraordinary. Yeah. Piece of work on stage and wonderful in Bilko.
Yeah.
But no disrespect to Steve. Steve's brilliant, but to watch Robbie do that, and you know, I know people, are, you know, there are people who Robbie was not to everybody's taste, but just to see.
Well, you couldn't have cast him as Bilko.
Just to sit in the cab watching him do that was a joy.
Yeah.
And you had American experiences, didn't you?
Yeah, well, that's
you
how
did
I went.
The sitcom.
I went sitcom. Oh,
but you were in Gorky Park. Come on.
Yeah, but that was an American movie shooting in Britain. I've done lots of American movies shot in Europe.
That's a different thing.
Yeah, for good or ill. But
if you go as a lead comic, there are problems because you're out of your comfort zone.
You don't know what's going on. But I think it changed with. I mean, the shitbags like Sacha Baron Cohen managed to be big in the States. Ricky Gervais, we all love.
I think it's different if you're playing if it's a conceptual character.
Yeah.
And you're working with American talent that like you. So if you're working in a situation where the writers and the producers and the directors know you and like what you do, that's different to going there and working with people you don't know, who aren't fans.
I just think it's just they can see your work much easier now. You know what I mean? And people often, I went from meet and greet the first time I went to, and people would say, you know, I loved you in, I loved you in, they said, you send them a tape, which they wouldn't watch. They loved your tape. But they say, I loved you in Letter to Brezhnev, they would say to me. And I'd say, no, that's Fred Molina. And then finally I would say, yeah, thanks. Yeah, it was a wonderful experience. You know, I'd say, yeah, we had a great time. You know, that scene, I've got the confidence. You know,
that's very funny.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Although it's very weird when you're the name above the title in the movie, you get to meet everybody. Before the movie comes out and the judgment is in, you meet everybody in Hollywood because they all want to meet this new guy.
Yeah.
So I have people knocking on my trailer door and I met the Hudlin brothers and I met this Suzanne DePass from Motown. And I met, I met Spike, and I met Robert Townsend. I met lots of mainly the
Bet black. You didn't meet them after the film flopped, though.
No,
that was
they don't write, they don't call. Although Robert Townsend did come to my house when I lived in Berkshire, he did show up and come to my house and
this
demand
is
that
the
I'm
producer of The Godfather.
No, Robert Townsend is the guy who made Hollywood Shuffle,
right.
And he's a very funny black comic, and he's a filmmaker. And he came to my house and made me make him his tea. And he was good. He was nice.
Anyway, so you come back to the UK then.
And we're talking early 90s now.
Yeah.
And
When was it you kept going off to New York and doing stand-up? Was that later?
That was early 90s, because I definitely had something to prove.
Yeah, right.
So late 80s, early 90s, I kept going to New York for a month to do stand-up at Catch a Rising Star. And I had a relationship with Lewis at Catch a Rising Star because we'd filmed the South Bank show there. And the gods were with me because I did a set that they caught on film where I did very well. And it was great. It was rocky that week, but by the time I got to the end of the week, I knew what I was doing. And so Lewis just said, anytime I want to come and do a set. So I'd come back and do a month and I'd do three sets a night and I was writing. And that's a tough thing to do. I think today's stand-up, because we ditch the set after a year or so or put it on tape or something, it's incumbent on you to write a new set. And I don't know very many comics who
can
write.
I don't know why they do that. That's bloody Stuart. Tommy's fault, I think.
Tommy Cooper never, ever wrote a new set. He might do a new bit.
Yeah.
Eric and Ernie might have a new bit they put in, but you don't write a whole new set.
Fuck off.
So I went into a thing where I went, oh, I better write a new 2 hours. Nobody does that.
Yeah.
So it got me into trouble. Seinfeld said it took him 2.5-3 years to write the new hour and a half, and it wasn't, it was all right.
Yeah, appreciate
it. Wasn't as good.
Seinfeld, yeah.
So it's kind of, I went down the road of get rid of all of,
no,
hang on, that's me. Wait a second, let me get my phone.
That's right. I don't want this.
He's just going.
Are you expecting a delivery?
Oh, it's the cat acupuncturist.
So this is, I have a bulletin for people. Wilf Mbanga, I'm afraid, is not very well. And there's a cat acupuncturist just.
That's the funniest shit in the universe.
You wouldn't think Alexei Sayle is employing a cat acupuncturist.
Oh my God. When does the cat Pilates teacher show up? I want to see that.
Yeah.
Cat Reiki guy.
Yeah. She's just on some bugs. All right. That's all right.
Where's the cat?
Oh,
what's the cat? The cat's dug a tunnel. All I can hear is did. So after the film, it was really tough. Carried on doing stand-up, which was making me miserable by then.
Yeah. When was the production? When was Crucial Films as well? Because that's another trailblazer.
When I came back from America, the thing was, listening to Eddie and various people, was be in control of your work.
Yeah.
Don't let other people tell you what to do and how to assess your work. You be the person that assesses your work. you're the person that writes it or collaborates, and you make the work. So I came back from America, a bit despondent, and I did two things. We did two things. We adopted a baby, but we also started a production company called Crucial Films, and we wanted to amplify marginalized voices in our community, so work with black and brown talent, working class talent, and make things that we wanted to see. And we made Chef and Neverwhere, and we made this thing called Funky Black Shorts, which is all new writers, all new directors, Crucial Tales, all new writers. We did the Lenny Henry Show again, and we did stuff that we wanted to do. And it was pretty good all the way through the 90s. Won awards. We're in textbooks now as a thing that was a game changer.
Yeah.
We did a thing called A Step Forward, which was we had a four-day thing in a hotel where we got all these working class black, brown, LGBTQ writers together. And we just talked at them. We got everybody in the industry to come and do lectures and seminars and things. And we talked at them for 4 days. And at the end, we had a sketch writing competition. And my brother Paul won. My brother Paul won the funniest sketch competition. But it was a really good thing. And it was in all the newspapers. And it's in textbooks now as a thing you can do.
Right, right.
And
it seemed to, but it, I mean, it seemed to weigh on you as well, though. Am I being unfair there as well?
No,
that you were you were carrying all that weight.
You had to do it. I mean, I had a lot
Yeah, no, I mean,
if you're going to do it and you're going to be in that position, and it's sort of a bit like that today, although I've been representing the whole diversity and inclusion thing, which gets on people's nerves now. you can't say anything anymore. But it's a thing that if you're black and in the public eye, the reason why everybody gets up and goes, do you know what? This is so great. And as I look out at this audience, I see that there's four or five black and brown people, and I salute you for getting here, but there's a long way to go. But they always say the same thing. It's because it's true. You look at the Oliviers, you look at BAFTA, you look at any of those award ceremonies. Award ceremonies are your peers saying, well done to you, you did a good job. And yet the people that get up to accept the awards are never fully diverse. There's always, in the course of Oppenheimer, did you see that at the BAFTAs?
No.
This bloke got up with everybody to collect the Best Movie Award, and he wasn't one of the crew. He was just some random bloke who decided he was going to get up. So that, to me, says a lot about award ceremonies. If it's about the industry saying, well done, we've got a long way to go.
Hello, listener. Sorry to interrupt the podcast, but just coming in as usual as a little... Actually, you know what? There's someone here who could say it better than me.
Patreon, give money to our Patreon, which is... Alexis, what is it? I never know. It's obviously a psychological flaw, something Freudian that I can't remember.
It's hard begging for money, but you know what? Yeah. We're doing this for free, and you know, anything you can't supply us with comes out of Alexi's pocket, and it's not fair, man. The man suffered enough, haven't you, Alexi?
This shit for free. Yeah, I have, yeah.
So, you know, help the show out, help keep the machine running, the wheels turning, and, you know, help pay my bills for doing the work, putting the show together. If you want to help out, patreon.com/AlexiSale podcast. Every now and then we throw little exclusive tidbits on there just for Patreon subscribers. And you'll be supporting a good cause. You'll be helping keeping this shit going, because we don't take adverts. We're not commercial, mainstream. It's all just grassroots. You know, fucking podcast, extreme underground podcasting, and be part of the movement, guys. Come on.
Yeah, all that.
All right, should we go back to Lenny?
Yeah.
All right, go back we go then.
So that was the 90s, Crucial. Where were your offices? Did you have offices?
We had an office.
Actually, I wanted a production company because I wanted like an office and like a reception.
Liam at the Groucho, early days of the Groucho Club, used to let me write at the Groucho. They'd never do that now. But I used to be able to write downstairs.
Yeah.
Then he gave me an office, which is above a sex shop on Old Compton Street. So there were three of us in this office. And it was me and Polly McDonald and... Beverly. And it was basically, I'd write something and go, what do you think of this poll? She'd go, that's great. let's write 2 pages and send it to the BBC. And we were funded by the BBC, so they wanted to do stuff.
Right.
Took a while to get something away, but right. Actually they wanted to do stuff with us because they'd funded us. And we were, I guess we were their diversity yeah. initiative. And it worked, actually. Yeah. They funded Chef, they funded Neverwhere, they funded Funky Black Shorts, and they listened to us as a production company. It's much more difficult
now. How did you feel things were going then?
In the 90s, yeah. Well, it's difficult when you've got a production company because things kind of stop in other areas. So
yeah.
I was still doing stand-up, but I wasn't doing as much. And we were doing Chef. So Chef went all the way through the 90s and Crucial produced Chef. So thankfully...
I remember you doing research at that restaurant in Ortolan, yeah, yeah. Who later turned out to be hideously physically abused.
That wasn't John Burton Race. He had a... one of his staff members was a bully, and they caught him on film kicking somebody, and that was on the telly, unfortunately.
Right, yeah.
But John just used to yell, right. And it was kind of rock star chef, you know.
Yeah.
When it came to cooking the place en papote or the fish in the balloon, that's when John came out because it was difficult and nobody else could do it. But everything else, the prep, the meat, they did that. But John came in and did the difficult stuff.
Right.
He was a great, great chef. And I think my daughter, when she was little, got used to eating really fancy food for quite a long time of her early childhood.
Oh, father, these escargots are...
These are not to my liking. Take it to Little Chef. What is this shit?
Jack. Yeah.
But it was a really good experience, and I got to work in a kitchen for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And it was very funny because, I worked on the prep, I worked on my knife skills and everything, but I'm not a chef. I can't do that shit properly. And then when the show went out, I had a lookalike do my hands right. for the knife skills and everything. And when my family saw it for the first time, they watched the show and it was like, that's not Uncle Lin. Lin's hands are darker than that.
Found out. So, all right, so carry on then. I mean...
So post-Chef, we finished with Crucial Films. That became... I had to stop... My mum died and there were other things going on in my life that I just thought... I can't deal with my personal shit and do a production company as well. So we decided to scrap the production company. And I was a bit down with all of these things. And Clive Tullow from Tiger Aspect said, who's a friend as well as a colleague, said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I was doing drama because drama's easier to do for us than in comedy. Drama was somebody else writes a text.
Yeah.
You read it, you go, I like this.
Yeah.
All I've got to do is learn it and act. Okay, I'll do that. Don't tell anybody. So I did Hope and Glory with Lucy Gannon, and I loved the experience of it because Lucy's a great writer. But while I was doing it...
Was that the first sort of big acting role?
Yeah. And while I was doing it, I met Tony Gardner and Gresby Nash, and we just messed around a lot in between takes, and we were doing characters and being funny, and how weird is that? At a period when I wasn't doing that and I was in a serious thing and having to do serious shit, in between takes, all we wanted to do is make the crew laugh. So this is the gods talking to you. And in this down moment, Clive told us, what do you want to do? What do you think you want to do? And I said, I think I want to do, I want to make them laugh again. I want to do something funny. And it was coming up to the 2000s. And we did this Lenny Henry in Pieces, but I wanted to do it not with an audience. I wanted to do it single camera. And I wanted the sketches to be like movies, not like sketches. So it means you've got to shoot it in a different way and you've got to work with a different director who's had that experience. And yes, there'd be characters, but there'd be parodies of films. And so it was just a different way of thinking. And so we did all that and we got a massive writing team together, Bert and George and all of these people, and we just came up with this stuff, and my brother Paul helped out. Mrs. Johnson, Paul rang up and said, I've just seen this guy at a funeral trying to chat up the widow, and it was really funny. I said, what did he say? He said, me as I bull, you as I call, your husband's not in the way anymore. You should do that. It was very funny.
Yeah.
And so we did that, and it was, and we got the Golden Rose of Montreux for that.
Yeah.
And we did 4 years of it. So we got into the 2000s. But I was still, heaven knows, I'm still miserable. and I can't shake the misery. And everything else is all right. I'm just, I'm not happy with the the stand-up's not really doing what I want it to
I
do.
I had that
you know?
Sense that,
it wasn't great. I came and talked to you, I think.
Yeah.
What am I doing? What's going on?
I probably gave you some bad advice.
The vibe's still good. What was great was me and the audience were fine. Yeah. It was just the generating of the material. And I was talking to directors and thinking, is it... And what happens with... If you're a comedian, you work with a director. Directors very much privilege the concept and not the jokes. So you get less laughs, but you get a more coherent storyline. And it was kind of like I was doing an Edinburgh show again. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go on and barnstorm. But what was happening was the laugh quotient went down, but the meaning of the show went up. And it was problematic for me.
Yeah.
So I kind of went through all that. And by the time we got to 2010, I'd had it up to here with stand-up. And the opportunity came to do a play with Barry Rutter at Northern Broadsides. And I'd done a radio show called What's So Great About Shakespeare? And I talked to all these actors about Shakespeare, saying, well, I don't get Shakespeare. What's the big deal? It's rubbish, blah, blah, blah. And people like Judy Dench schooled me, and Rutter schooled me, and Peter Hall schooled me. And I ended up with Rutter practicing the last speech of Othello in a cellar. And by the time we'd done the scene 14 times, something clicked in my head, and I said, this is what I need to be doing next.
And that, I saw that production. It was extraordinary.
And it just changed my life. It was a life changer because I'd never gone to acting school. I'd never trained. And it was like literally going to acting college for a year and a half. It was amazing. And I learned a great deal. And it still stands today, that performance.
Yeah.
And then from then it was Fences.
I saw that.
I did Educate and Rita, which wasn't as you were there too. Hilarious.
Well, you know, I mean, it was, you know.
It was experience. And actually what was great was, being a comic, what was great, what happened, listeners, is I went on and Rita has a 5-page speech and I'm playing the other guy. There's only two of us in the play. And I think I drifted off.
It's on the opening night.
I think I drifted off on the opening night. This is not a good look for me. Lex is there. My partner Lisa is there. And I look up and I see Lashana Lynch, who's brilliant, who's just in a bravura 5-page speech in Scouse playing Rita. And she's looking at me going, it's you now. And I look up at the audience and Lisa, my partner's got her head in her hands. And Alexis Sayles looking at me like, all right, there. And I look at the audience and there's a quite, in my brain it's 5 minutes, but it was probably 40 seconds. And I said, I'm going to nip off now and I'm going to figure out what's going on and then I'll be back in a minute. And thankfully the audience is brilliant and they let me go off.
Now I think that was the right decision as well. Because it's, I mean, that's, I mean, stating the, I mean, that is the thing about, theatre is it's live, it's happening right there.
And you can stop the show.
You can stop the show.
And I did it again. We were doing Fences and we came on and somebody had their phone on and the football, you could hear it was the football.
Right.
And we started, you know, whatever we were doing, me and Colin, and I stopped and said, I said in my, because we were talking in a kind of Pittsburgh voices, but in my own voice, I said, I'm really sorry, but somebody's phone's on. Could they turn it off, please? I said, we'll start again. We'll come back out again. Yeah. But do you mind turning your phone off? And we got a round of applause and the guy turned his phone off and we went off, we waited for a minute and we came back on and started the play. It's all right to do that. Whenever I read that in the paper of Hugh Jackman or somebody stopping the play, I go, good.
It's stop real, you know, it's happening right there and then. So, you know, what the fuck you done? You can break out of that world, but then you just go back into it,
And I do love the theatre. I'm doing another play next year. I just did a play, a one-man show at the Bush. And there's just something different about it. I do like it. And what's great, hopefully, is that I am beginning to think I want to do stand-up again because I've been doing book tours and I've noticed the audience really like it when you tell funny stories.
Book tours are a fucking gift because somebody's, you know, you don't have to get a laugh, but if you do get a laugh, they're so grateful.
Yeah.
That's how I got back into doing stand-up was by doing book tours.
In particular, when I was doing the memoir is all me talking about growing up in Dudley and being in show business and Bobby Ball arriving outside the North Pier in a very, very big car and not knowing how to work it. So I tell all these stories, which are naturally, they're stories. They're not, stand-up's different, but anecdotes are great.
It's your life and you're putting a comedic spin on it. It is stand-up.
Given that, and given how I've noticed the audience reaction to the stories. It's made me think, oh, well, I could do that.
Do that, exactly.
So I'm thinking about doing stand-up, but it may be another in a way that's not...
Yeah, well, that's what exactly... That is exactly my trajectory and, you know, I would...
I'm a big fan of your trajectory.
Yeah, you love my trajectory.
I hope I can see you do it. And do you sit down? Do you sit and chat?
No. I just stand up. It's what I've been doing.
Oh, so you're still, folks, is this mic on? He's still doing that. I know you're out
no,
there.
No.
Are you just talking to him, or do you adopt the persona, or is
no,
it
I
you
don't
now?
Have a persona anymore. It's me, yeah. It's
oh,
me.
Great.
So, yeah, yeah.
Well, good for you, man.
I've been doing it for a few years. You haven't come to see me yet.
Well, I remember you.
Yeah. So the other thing is that, I don't know.
The activism is the activism I can do. I think when politicians go, and I've got this comedian here, and he's going to say how great we are, that's a mistake. I don't think comedians really, this is just me, when I watch a politician and they wheel out somebody to do a tight five and to say vote such and such, my brain goes, oh no. And you talk to somebody, I was on Red Wedge, I was Amnesty International, I was Civil Liberties thing, and those things are all great, and I'm glad I did them, and I'm not sorry I did them. But actually, I do steer clear a bit of standing up and going, I think this, because who gives a shit?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm literally a man who stood in some custard on television and had water thrown at me. Who gives a shit what I think? I think personally, if I think something, listen, me and Daddy Tambo and various people, Mandela Day, loads of money goes in and says, where's my free Nelson Mandela? activism is good. And we're all trying to do the thing for the greater good. And I know you have your things that you do, and I have things that I do, but that's not really, that's my business. That's what I think. And the diversity and inclusion thing in the industry concerns all of us. So that's why that's public. That's why you make a speech at BAFTA. Because you go, hang on a minute, there's something going on in this industry, and we need to figure it out. And, the government, they're trying to stop us. They're trying to stop working class people from doing the arts.
Yes.
They're trying to deprivilege the arts because the arts is critical of politics, and they're trying to make it not important anymore. They're trying to stop our kids studying art. And you know what? Good luck to them, because art is how you figure things out. Art is thinking out of the box. Art is problem solving. If you haven't got that when you're working out policies, you're fucked. So I think activism is great, and you believe what you want to believe, and you use your vote. Because if you're a young person going, I don't know about voting, because what them guys done for me, the fact that people have fought for your vote, your mum and dad were in a union and did shit so that you could vote, it's really disrespectful to that memory to not use your vote. Fucking vote. What's the matter with you? Because, when the shit hits the fan, you've got nobody to blame but yourself if you didn't act. There's a great Martin Luther King thing about, the person who's the one to blame is the person that didn't say or do anything.
Right.
You don't want to be that guy or that woman who didn't say or do something. But, choose your hill. Choose the hill you want to die on.
Yeah, yeah. A bit pointless. I think I'd choose a pointless hill to die on, really.
What? He parked in my space.
I don't know. That would be
he podged in front of me in the queue.
There'd be something pointless, really.
I think where we are now is a very interesting place. And how weird that we're more political now than we were 50. I think people...
What do you mean by we?
I think there's a general feeling. All my friends, the people in my group now, are more likely to talk about political things than they were 20 years ago.
Really?
Yeah, they just...
In what sense?
They just talk about stuff that they think is... They talk about They talk about Trump. They talk about Israel. They talk about, they talk about race. They talk about all kinds of things at dinner.
Right.
Whereas they didn't used to do that.
Really? Okay.
I think people have become much more present and more outward facing than they used to be. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's something that comes to you as you get older. You think a bit more.
I suppose the jeopardy is. We could coast through the 90s or whatever because the stakes weren't that high. But now we've got
Do you think Thatcher was an exacerbator? For alternative comedy because it was she was such a good villain.
I don't know. It's hard to know, really, because obviously that
I mean, when a piece of kind of symbolism that Thatcher came to power on the day that the Comedy Store opened, more or less. And so you've got to say that there has to be a connection. I mean,
you kind of steered clear of it. I mean,
yeah,
and so did I actually. But there was a genuine sense of being more militant and being fearless in terms of subject matter.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly that the country was divided, that half the country hated her and half the country liked her, and obviously I performed to the half that hated her. And, it was a very fertile time artistically, really. I mean,
I think you're right. My thing, because I came from a more variety background, was that I'd have both in the audience, and if you made a joke about anything that was remotely political,
yeah,
there'd be a kind of a hissing or a booing if you really? Did a joke about Thatcher or if you did a joke about the Tories or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But Delbert talks mainly about the police and police brutality and stop and search and stuff. And generally, people go, yes, well, actually, the black people, they don't deserve that. But they didn't want to hear anything about Thatcher from me.
Well, you should have come and worked him up with my
notes. I did sometimes.
What
I noticed was, not that this is a bad thing, but it wasn't easy laugh to take the piss out of the Tories when you did Amnesty International or civil liberties and stuff. You only had to do half a joke about the Tory party. You get a huge roar of approval and around.
And that's why I always then would follow it up with something that was critical of the left, or because I didn't, I wasn't taking that easy, I think. That was an example of my brilliance. I don't know if you want to comment on my brilliance a bit more.
I think we've had more than enough of your brilliance during this podcast. But let's take that as a given and just say that my life was better for knowing you and for being involved in you and watching you and everybody around you, actually, kind of making a choice as to, well, I like that kind of thing. There was some alternative comedy work that I didn't understand. The thing of, let's not do anything funny and see if they laugh. I kept thinking, you've got to do something funny.
Comics, it's a joke.
Make me laugh. I erred on the side of the people that, Nigel doing kind of breakdancing or Dawn drop kicking a door or Arnold saying, why not? These were all things that made me laugh and were funny at varying levels of funny.
I do think you can sound a bit. I mean, I think the job is to make people laugh, really.
That has sometimes been forgotten. To make people laugh.
Yeah.
Tommy Cooper could make you laugh by breathing out. Yeah. That's funny. So anybody that did anything in the Venn diagram of, hello, here I am, I'm going to make you laugh now.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's my contract with you, and please honour it. And there were many, many people out there who didn't do that, who just thought saying cushion over and over was funny. It's not.
No, it's performance art. It's not fucking stand up. Turning into where.
I remember Kevin Meaney at Catch a Rising Star, and a joke didn't work. And he's saying, I don't care, I don't care. My jokes are not going over, I don't care. And he did that and he got a stunning ovation at the end. It was so funny.
Right.
So a joke didn't work and he just went into something else. Yeah. And similarly, Rick sort of just pulling his underpants over his navel. Come on, that's funny. And singing, ooh, you're a nutty bunch. That's funny.
Oh. All right, I feel like we haven't barely scratched the surface.
But we'll have to do another one.
Let's do another one.
Well, Lexi's going to do my podcast.
I'm working to do the podcast. Well, phew. Wow.
Phew.
Well, I hope you've got a, clear idea of Lenny now.
Mm.
And of me, I suppose, to some extent. I was refracted through him, so you just love me all the more. I don't know whether we should talk about the outside world, really. It's too depressing.
Well, it's hard to, fake the end. You watch these fucking panel shows and new quiz shows and talk shows, and you wonder, how is everyone so chirpy and got so much energy when the world's burning around us all?
Yeah, yeah.
What are they fucking doing?
Yeah.
But, we all saw the Labour conference and Keir Starmer's building a better Britain, isn't he?
Yeah, I'm excited to see it. He's a bad man. He's a very bad... They're all bad people, really. They're all poisoned by their own ambition and corruption.
It's, I think the most they give us now is saying there should be a ceasefire.
Yeah, just empty words, you know, just completely empty. Just
no condemnation,
hollow, you know. No, exactly. No, you know, no depiction of what's actually happening. It's just entirely vacuous. Just something to say. Ah, it makes me sick.
It's getting ugly out there, folks. What, it's expanding into Lebanon now.
Yeah.
We saw their kind of dirty, you know, hardware interference, make those pagers and walkie-talkies explode, but now they're just carpet bombing southern Lebanon.
Yep, yep.
And Beirut and...
I mean, it's a cowardly way to fight a war, isn't it? Just from the air, you know, with no you know, Lebanon, Hezbollah have no air to, ground to air, you know, they have no air defences. It's just, you're just in your F-35 jet just killing children, you know, from a couple of miles away. I don't know. There's no honor in that, I don't think.
Do you remember the last time the Israel Lebanon war?
Yeah, well, when they engaged, yes, well, that's why they're doing it from a distance, because if they engage with Lebanon, with Hezbollah on the ground, I think that they would, it would be a very different story. But they won't. They found that they can just, as with Gaza, they can just, you know, use artillery and airstrikes to flatten the place.
Mm.
It's extraordinary.
What's their aims now? What are, they? Because, you know, when they're blowing up Gaza,
yeah,
you think, okay, they want to claim it, they want to occupy it, and they want to kill everyone there. Or at least make them so shit scared that they're not going to fight anymore.
Yeah.
But is that-
Well, I think the same's true of, you know, I mean, certainly those messianic members of the Israeli government, like Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, you know, they want Lebanon. They want all of Eretz Israel. They want all of, you know, they want the West Bank. They want Gaza, and they want a substantial chunk of Lebanon. That's their vision. And, you know, maybe they can get, I mean, I think that, you know, you probably can use air power to degrade, you know, and, you know, the pager attacks and so on. You can use, I mean, it is such an asymmetrical war, this. I mean, the difference between, you know, I mean, sometimes the, you know, the media, the legacy media tries to make out there's some kind of equality. It's just, and it's always been the case that the technological superiority of Israel provided for them by the United States just gives them, you know, endless reach, and unless there's some political will to stop them, they can go on doing this forever. So they can, you know, they can Gazify southern Lebanon. They can probably destroy Hezbollah launch sites and, you know.
That word, Gazify.
I just make that up.
No, I've seen it in the press, but it's just a symbol of how much damage they've done in Gaza. It's really depressing that word is in the lexicon now. To Gazify something is to fucking ruin it completely and make it unlivable.
Yeah. And kill. I mean, they've killed over 700 in the West Bank. They've killed 30 or 40 today in Gaza. You know, I mean, it's just, and nobody seems to do anything to stop. So, I mean, I don't know. I can't. Maybe they'll get what they want. I mean, what happens then? I don't know. This insane, psychopathic country, really, a country with murderous ideology.
And it's affecting your day to day?
Yo, fuck yeah. No, I feel terrible, frankly. It's making me ill.
Yeah.
Woohoo!
Well, if you're feeling the same out there, listeners, then, you know, you're not alone. And, yeah, mate, I'm fucking Arab and I'm seeing my cousins basically being treated like this and no one helping them.
Yeah.
Even, you know, disappointingly, even fellow Arabs, they're not fucking pooling together.
That's one of the great, you know.
It's such a tragedy because they don't want to, what? They don't want to get involved. They don't want to escalate.
Well, they don't want to. They're all things. They're all dictatorships. They're all dictatorships that are in hock. You know, I mean, the most Israel gets the most U.S. foreign aid, and the country that gets the second most foreign aid is Egypt, and that's a bribe not to attack Israel. And then Saudi Arabia is roped into Saudi Arabia. You know, all the Gulf Emirates are all roped into the now part of the American sphere of influence.
You got Yemen, though. They're the only ones, but they're such Yemen effect. But like
Yemen and Iran and just, you know.
But like countries like here in the US, and more so, you know, you see footage from the streets in the Middle East and the protests.
Yes.
And they're so much bigger than what we've got going on. Like the people are feeling it. And the people, it's just like here, we're just feeling so angry and despondent, and our governments are just not reflecting.
Mm, yeah, and the same is true. And I mean, nothing's gonna. I could all those, you know, that all those, you know, those Arab dictatorships are not gonna give their own people what they want. They make noises. I mean, like Erdogan in Turkey, they make noises, but I doubt that they will do anything concrete, really.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we are.
Any hope? Any turning point coming?
No, I mean, I suppose there is, people are working, Jeremy and the Independents and Jamie Driscoll and Andrew Feinstein are working to form some kind of a political bloc, you know, independent socialist political bloc in Britain, really. In France, the socialists got the most votes, and they're still in the end. Yet somehow France ends up with a far right government. You know, there are efforts to try and work through the democratic process to counteract the rightward shift of our politics. Really, I mean, and it's, you know, these are good people, and I will try and do everything I can to help them succeed. I think it's a tough struggle.
All right. Well, I guess. All right, we'll check in next time. See how we're doing.
Yeah.
But
where's Godzilla when you need them?
All right, shall we sign off then?
Yeah, all right. All right. Happy trails, everybody.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.